reason I mention that is there's a Wisconsin Independent College and a Wisconsin Foundation for this, that, and the next thing, so we always use the full name to keep it.
Okay, now we're going to try again. This is Barry Tyker of the UW Oral History Project. I am here with Mr. Robert Rennebaum of the University of Wisconsin Foundation at the Foundation offices on 150 East Gilman. The date is December 20th, 1989. Today we're going to discuss your background and your undergraduate education here at the university. Could you begin by telling us when and where you were born and a little bit about your early educational experiences?
I was born in La Crosse, Wisconsin on February 20th, 1923. I attended and graduated from La Crosse Central High School in the class of 1940 and stayed out of school a year before I came down here to the university.
What made you decide to attend the UW-Madison?
Ever since I was a little boy, I wanted to attend the university. Perhaps it was because we would visit relatives in Madison, and I had an opportunity as a young boy to see the campus and become excited by it. And so it was really my one goal in life as I went through high school was to attend the university, and I was fortunate enough to do that.
When you came here, what were you thinking about in terms of a major, in terms of a career, and things like that?
Well, I enjoyed science and was particularly good at chemistry in high school, chemistry and math, so I decided to major in chemistry. However, I was down here on what one might call a football scholarship at that time, which consisted of two jobs, one to work enough to make meals and the other was to earn enough to pay for your board. So you didn't really have as much time as the kids today do with the tenders that they're offered, and I was just snowed under trying to remain a chemistry major, but it was my goal to be a chemist when I came.
Let's skip right ahead to football since you brought it up. Now, you played in high school.
Yes, I was fortunate enough to be an all-city selection up there my last 2 years, and I also played baseball and was a member of the American Legion state championship team in 1939 in La Crosse. I came down here primarily to get an education, of course, but the opportunity to play football was also available to me, so I did participate in the football program here all the while I was in school.
We hear so much today about big-time recruiting. It's almost as important, sometimes more important than the actual game itself. What did recruiting consist of in 1941?
In 1941, Harry Stuhlderer was the coach of Wisconsin, and I got a message in my class to go down to the principal's office, as Mr. Stuhlderer was there to say hello to me, and incidentally there were two other boys from Central. We came down here together, but it consisted of Harry Stuhlderer standing in the hall and telling us that they would find us meal jobs and room jobs, and that they'd love to have us come to play at the University of Wisconsin. So the recruiting took about 10 minutes in my case, and I said that I thought I would come.
I guess it wasn't too hard since your dream had been to come here all along.
Right.
Hard sell at the...
Actually, we were recruited also by the University of Minnesota because La Crosse is right on the border of Wisconsin and Minnesota, and there are a great many Minnesota fans in La Crosse, alumni and fans, and there was a lot of urging on the part of Minnesota backers for us to go to Minnesota, but the three of us, which was Russ Schultz and Johnny Anderson and myself, decided that we wanted to come here.
Did Minnesota actually recruit you?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
The same banner generally?
Yeah, they were a little more aggressive actually. They pursued us a little more aggressively, I would say, but But again, my ambition was to come here, so I didn't pay too much attention to it.
Was there any kind of a limit back then on the numbers of students you could promise to find meal jobs for?
No, no, there was no limit to that, unlike the present day where you have a limited number of football scholarships.
In terms of football, we'll get into the academics in a minute. In terms of football, what was UW's reputation at the time?
Well, Wisconsin was coming off a very poor season in 1940 and 41. And however, they had some good young ball players, Pat Harder and Dave Schreiner, and they were coming up playing well as sophomores and juniors. And so it looked like Wisconsin was on the rebound and ready to come out with a good team. When we got down here, of course, Elroy Hirsch had joined us from Wausau, and Elroy was a star attraction as far as recruiting went, and he had two friends with him from Wausau as well, Hank Olshansky and Rodney Lilliquist. And the six of us were placed in the same rooming house together, so we had three from Wausau and three from La Crosse, and we had many grand arguments over the height of Granddad Bluff versus Rib Mountain, and we were all together and we had a great time. It's particularly a tough time to be away from home, you know, the first semester of your freshman year. We were all working, we were all playing football, we were all studying, and it seemed quite difficult for part of that time, but gradually we became assimilated and it went along very well.
Now, you mentioned a person whose name I've heard several times over the years, David Schreiner. Mm-hmm. Was he not one of the two football players who went overseas and was...
Yes, from our 1942 team, we lost two of the starting members of that team, Dave Schreiner, the right end, and Bob Bauman, the left tackle. And they were both Marine officers. Schreiner was killed in Okinawa, and Bauman was killed in Okinawa as well.
The conference, was it the Big Eight back then?
Michigan State hadn't joined. It was really the Big Nine, because Chicago was out of it. And Michigan State had not come in yet. They came in after the war.
So there was an odd number, as we will now have again.
Yes, the Big 11.
I should point out for a historical footnote here, for those of you 20 years from now who are listening to this, we've just learned it within the last week that Penn State is going to be joining the Big Ten in football in, what, 1995 or something?
Something like that.
Something along those lines.
That's a great addition.
Let's go to classes for a minute before we get back to football. Your major was chemistry.
Yes, and as a chemistry major, I had to take German and mathematics and English and chemistry, and I was working 2 hours a day for my meals, and I worked about 6 hours a week for my room, earn enough to pay for my room, and It just was a very difficult schedule, to say the least. I had to drop German at the 6 weeks exam, or when it was still okay to drop it, I dropped German and had to make up the credits in my second semester in order to be eligible for the next fall.
What were the eligibility requirements?
Well, I forget the exact number of credits. I think it was something like 24 credits as a freshman in order to be eligible for, I think it was 12 credits per semester.
Did they have a GPA requirement as well?
Oh, yes. Yeah, I forget what it was, but we had to maintain a good scholastic average or you were out.
Now, getting back to chemistry for a minute, are there any particular chemistry teachers who stand out, courses that stand out as being important, either because they were good or because they were bad or whatever?
I took you know, the general chemistry course for chemistry majors, and we had a variety of lectures. It was quite a big course, had a variety of lectures. So one professor who stood out was the late Harvey Sorum. He was particularly a good lecturer, and he made it enjoyable to observe him. It was a lot of fun to take chemistry from him. And I even recall meeting, I believe it was Dr. Kaltenberg, who was one of the early stars of the chemistry department. I think the book that we were using was written by him, and had a brief interview with him. Rather stern old gentleman. It was very interesting.
In terms of your early freshman and sophomore years in chemistry, what were the classes like? Were they generally lecture type classes?
Well, as I recall, we had two big lectures a week, and then we had two quiz sections each week, and I believe that was it. I think there were two lectures and two quiz sections.
And
it might have been only one quiz section, but
later on, were the classes smaller in your?
Actually, I dropped being a chemistry major after my freshman year. I knew I couldn't work my way through school, play football, and major in chemistry. So I shifted to the College of Agriculture, where I could use the chemistry background that I had, and eventually ended up majoring in dairy and food industry, which was the processing of dairy products and food products.
Yeah, I see your book here. You have dairy industry down. What about outside of chemistry? Were there any particular instructors that you took who influenced you?
There was a young professor of English who was very kind to me. I enjoyed him very much. I can't for the life of me remember his name, but he took an interest in us as freshmen, knowing that this was a pretty big world, and made it I think a lot easier to participate in his class. I had a record in high school. I didn't realize it at the time, but I had straight A's in all of my mathematics classes. So when I got down here with that kind of record, they threw me in with the brightest freshmen that were enrolled. And I had a very difficult time with the math, because I learned as I was down here that the teacher in La Crosse was a rather easy teacher, and I didn't know nearly as much as I thought I knew. But I got through it all right, but it was a real chore.
I noticed in your yearbook also that you were a member of the Babcock Dairy Science Club. Could you tell us a little bit about that and any other clubs and organizations that you were involved with?
Well, being a dairy industry major, the Babcock Science Club was a group of people who would gather and for a social gathering to discuss possibilities in the industry that we were majoring in. Mostly, I believe, to invite outside speakers in who would tell us about what the real world of processing dairy products was all about, and what we might expect after graduation. But it wasn't a real active organization. We maybe met once a month. Otherwise, I was a member of the W Club, and there too, it didn't meet very often. But I really didn't have time to participate in a lot of outside activities. Playing football took so many hours, and the working and the studying, we just didn't have time to socialize beyond with our own roommates and our own teammates.
you mentioned bringing people in with the Babcock Club speakers. Mm-hmm. Did you, as when you were in the School of Ag, did you go to farms? Did you do any kind of, or did you work in the barns here? Any type of work in the barns on campus?
No, I was in the other end of the dairy business. I was in the processing of the milk product. We would take milk, and we had our classes in Hiram Smith Hall. I believe it's now preserved as a historical landmark. But we would make ice cream there. We would make cheese. We would make butter, and we didn't deal with the cow end of the milk business. We dealt with the milk end of it.
Was Babcock ice cream going strong?
Oh yes, yes. You could get Babcock ice cream, but one thing I've found through the years that more people, as I spoke to alumni clubs around the country, would come up and tell me how they existed during the Depression on buttermilk. You would buy a paper cup for a penny, and then you could drink all the buttermilk you wanted, and many people would make it part of their daily food intake would be to march up to Hiram Smith Hall and pay a penny for a cup and drink buttermilk there to sustain themselves.
I talked to a gentleman the other day. He said they used to get a glass of water and put ketchup in it, kind of swirl it around. It'd be like a like a V8 juice or something.
Well, in 1941, when I started school here, there was still remnants of the Great Depression. As far as it certainly was on everyone's mind, and there wasn't a lot of money floating around, and people would use every possible means to get a good meal and pay for their education.
You mentioned that you started out living in a boarding house with Elroy Hirsch and his two colleagues from Wausau and your two friends from La Crosse. Where was the boarding house?
It was at 812 West Johnson Street, which is now the location of one of the theaters in the Vilas Communication Hall. It was the typical three-story rooming house, and we lived with a family named Hanley, and they were, I believe he was a custodian at the university, and they would every so often have a house meeting, which meant cookies and milk. And we would frequently stir up a discussion with them that we thought should lead to another session of cookies and milk, because again, anytime you get something to eat, you were all for it.
Which floor did you live on?
We lived on the second floor. Hirsch and Oshansky had a room, and Rush Olson and I had a room that was separated by a sliding door. When we got there, it was closed, and after we became good friends, in a few days, we had opened up the door, and we had one big two-room suite that the four of us lived in, and it was very enjoyable.
Did the Hanleys live below then?
Yes, they lived below. And if we would get too noisy, we had a buzzer system for the telephone that three longs was your call. She would ring the buzzer for a prolonged period of time. That meant we'd be quiet, and we used to tease her by yelling, "Who's the call for? Who's the call for?"
board included in the?
Board was $15 a month. In those days, and we had jobs working for the Madison Business Association, which was a forerunner to the Madison Chamber of Commerce. It was the they would hire the athletes who were on quote scholarship, and we would canvass the square and the surrounding streets, taking down the license numbers of cars, and then going back to the Park Hotel where the offices were located and looking up the license numbers to see where the shoppers were coming from, if they were coming from Mount Horeb or Sun Prairie or from Madison or where. And it was a means of determining the customer base for the square businesses. And it may have been a little, or some might call it unnecessary, but we worked legitimately. We got good pay in those days, 75 cents an hour, and we were permitted to work just enough hours to get our $15 a month for our room. And then as far as the meal job was concerned, you had, in those days, you would work an hour per meal. So every evening after football practice at about 6:30, there were four of us who worked in Lawrence's restaurant on University Avenue across from the old hospital. We would go in there and scrub pots and pans for 2 hours so that we could stop in at noon and have our noon meal and have our evening meal as well.
I think we should play this tape to some undergraduates today. Take a lot of these things for granted. How long did you live at the boarding house?
We lived at 812 West Johnson for 1 year, and then we moved to the 400 block of North Murray Street, right where the A.W. Peterson building is now. And we moved over there in our sophomore year. And again, it was Hirsch and Oshansky. Russ Schultz had failed in his schooling and was out of school, so I had a single room at that place. But Hirsch and Oshansky were still there. And we also teamed up in that same house with Walt Lautenbach and Bob Sullivan, who were basketball players and baseball players as well.
Now, you were a baseball player in high school, weren't you?
Yes. Uh-huh. And I played here in 1943. You'd do anything to get out of spring football practice. And I had the baseball background, so much to Harry Stuhler's chagrin, I did go participate in baseball and skip football. Well, I knew I wasn't going to be back here the following fall because we had enlisted in the Marine Corps and the war was underway and we knew we'd be gone, so I thought I might as well spare myself being knocked around on the football field all spring and play baseball instead, which I enjoyed because I did win my letter and played outfield for the Badgers that year. Incidentally, one of the reasons people would try to get out of spring football, it started in February, and our first practices were in the Stock Pavilion. And we would practice, I think it was 3 days a week in the Stock Pavilion. And frequently, we'd come in and see them leading the cows and the sheep out of the building, and then we would proceed to play football where the cows and the sheep had been. And it was interesting, to say the least. In fact, we used to joke that the sparrows would follow us home from practice.
what were the practices? Let's go to fall football now. Tell us a little bit. Start out by telling us a little bit about Harry Stuhldreher as a coach.
Well, Harry Stuhldreher had been one of the original four horsemen at Notre Dame, and of course. He was a legend in his own time, so to speak. He was the quarterback of that team, and he was just a wonderful gentleman and a very good coach. He was also the athletic director, and today we talk of having one person do the athletic director's job as well as coach. And it had an adverse effect on his coaching, I'm sure, that he had all those administrative duties to handle as well. But also in those days, we only had three assistant coaches and a freshman coach. And so you had a backfield coach, a line coach, and an end coach to help out the head coach. But Harry took the 1942 team, which was one of Wisconsin's great teams, and it consisted of a group of sophomores and holdovers like Pat Harder and Dave Schreiner and Bob Bauman, Jack Wink, and
there is the squad there. That is it, right?
Yeah, Fred Nagus. We had a wonderful group of ball players, and lost only one game that year. We were playing through most of the year. We were regarded as contenders for the national championship. And we went down to play Iowa and got beat 6-0. We contend we really didn't get beat, that Pat Harder had gone over the goal line with a tying touchdown, but the referee said that he didn't get over the line, so we were beaten 6-0. And interesting, it was wartime, and we had to go down to Iowa in a motor caravan. Businessmen in Madison were given an extra ration of gas to drive us to Iowa City and back. And when we lost that game, it was such a bitter pill to swallow that the car I was in, I forget who was driving, but there were four or five of us in the car. We didn't say a word. There wasn't a word said in the car. The radio was on until we got, perhaps near Dubuque. And they came on the radio with a special announcement that the American Army had invaded North Africa, that we had landed in North Africa to initiate the campaign in Europe. And then we began talking about the war, but nobody talked about the game all the way home, 180 miles from Iowa City and Madison. Nobody mentioned the fact that we were perhaps beaten out of the national championship. And as it turned out, that did cost us the championship because we won the rest of our games, and I think we were rated number two or number three at the end of the year.
Is that the highest rating UW has ever
had? I think it was, yeah. I think it has been the highest rating that we've had.
Wasn't the basketball team right up there?
Oh, the basketball team, yeah, in 1941, 42. I believe that was the year, 40, 41, had won the NCAA championship with Johnny Cotts and Gene England and Fred Rame. They had a great basketball tradition here at that time. And we again, and after the war, Walt Lautenbach and Glenn Selbo and Ed Mills took us to the finals of the national NCAA championship in New York, but they were beaten that year, so we didn't win the championship, but we were right in there to the end.
What position did you play in?
Football? Mm-hmm. I played left end, and in those days, you played both ways. You didn't get a rest. You had to, of course, the mark of great accomplishment was to be a 60-minute player where you played the entire game both ways. And in baseball, I played outfield.
Did you catch, was it pretty much structured as it is today? The ends are essentially the pass catchers?
The ends and the halfbacks were the pass receivers. We didn't have what you call split ends in those days. We played tight to the line of scrimmage, and you really didn't pass very much at all. It was primarily a running offense, 3 yards in a cloud of dust, I guess you would call it. But we did occasionally throw. I would imagine the only time we threw the ball was on third down and long yardage. Rest of the time you were grinding away at some 200, and in those days the tackles were 210 pounds, 215 pounds. That was pretty big man then. I weighed 195 as an end, which was and I was 6 foot tall, so today that wouldn't last very long on one of the teams with a 6'5" ends and 215 pound lineman. I mean, 215-pound ends. The halfbacks are 200 pounds now.
And faster than...
Yeah.
What about your quarterback? Who was your quarterback then?
Our quarterback was Jack Wink. Played high school football in Milwaukee. And he was a very, very good quarterback. He unfortunately hurt his knee, had a dislocated knee. And in those days, there was no such thing as arthroscopic surgery. You went in under the big knife, and invariably, if you had a bad knee, you were a bad knee forever. You never really got rid of it. And Jack used to play the last couple games of his sophomore year, which was before we went in service. After the war, he wore this big metal brace. Incidentally, he was good enough, his knee was good enough to get in the Marine Corps and stay in the Marine Corps.
Was Elroy Hirsch the featured back?
Yes, Elroy Hirsch and Pat Harder gave us a combination that was really exceptional. Harder was a bruising fullback that would rather run into somebody than run around him, whereas Hirsch would jump over him and jump around him and use his speed to do a lot of good running. But it was, and then we had the threat of Dave Schreiner as a pass receiver. He was the best football player that I ever saw in any position. And when he had a nucleus like that with Fred Nagus at center, why, it's little wonder that we were rated at the top.
Did Elroy Hirsch have his nickname at that point?
No, we called him Ghost at that time. He had the nickname from high school of Ghost, I guess because of his ability to be gone. And he picked up that nickname later in the 1942 season, I think. There's speculation on who actually called him Crazy Legs for the first time, but supposedly he made a long run against the Great Lakes team down in Soldiers Field, and a Chicago sports writer called him Crazy Legs because he had the habit of throwing his legs out to the side. He, as Elroy describes it, he said he runs like a girl.
Was Great Lakes, is that the naval?
That was the naval training station outside of Chicago. And during the war, your major bases around the country would have football and baseball teams. And, of course, they would try to get professional athletes to be on these teams. It was a method of entertaining the troops and the sailors. I know that I was stationed at Pearl Harbor during the closing days of the war, and I stayed on there for that fall to play on a Marine All-Star football team. Fred Nagus of Wisconsin was on that same team, but again, the purpose was to provide entertainment for the troops and to try to beat the Navy and the Army, which we weren't very successful at doing. So,
now, you told me before the interview, one of the things I was interested in, particularly about interviewing you, was the fact that this Marine team was formed in 1943. And why don't you explain exactly?
Well,
how you came about?
In 1942, when we had that good Wisconsin team, we knew that we were all destined to go into the service. So it was pretty well established that Wisconsin was going to get a Marine contingent as part of a naval program. And again, we knew that if we were stationed here, that we'd be able to play football here. Well, naturally, we wanted to play at Wisconsin, so quite a number of us, I forget the exact number, but we all joined the Marine Corps Reserve. Well, we learned later that at the time, Clarence Dykstra was president of the university, and the Navy came to him with a proposal that they would pay him X number of dollars per naval person on the campus for training. And they said, you have your choice of 1,000 Marines and sailors or 2,000 women sailors. And of course, rumor had it that he saw the dollar sign per person and chose the 2,000 women sailors, whereas the Marines shipped us to the University of Michigan. And we joined there with young men from Michigan State University and Michigan, and were immediately eligible to play football for Michigan that fall. So there were 15 of us on the squad, and I think in one particular game there were 8 of us from Wisconsin were in the starting lineup for Michigan. And we won the Big Ten championship that year at Michigan, tied with Purdue, incidentally, and Purdue also had a Marine contingent. There were the haves and the have-nots in those days. Wisconsin didn't get any program that produced any football players, so they had a very poor 1943 and 44 season. Whereas Michigan, because of the Marines and the Navy, big programs there, they had excellent football. Notre Dame had excellent football. They had a program, Northwestern, and Minnesota did not, so they were at the bottom of the conference as well.
Did you, in that year, play UW?
Yes. Yes, as a matter of fact, we played Wisconsin, and 2 weeks before we played them, we had a semester break at Michigan, and we came back here, all of us, all of the Wisconsin boys, we came back for the weekend, and it held over Monday, so we went out and practiced with the Badgers on Monday afternoon, and 2 weeks later, while we were playing against them in Michigan Stadium.
Coach Stuhldreher have anything to say to
you? He said he wanted to kidnap us and keep us here.
Okay, let's see.
Incidentally, we beat Wisconsin, but we didn't try as hard as you might expect a player to try, so it was a relatively low score. I think it was 27-0, but we could have really run it up.
Let's go back a year now to Wisconsin. Did Wisconsin have any arch rivals in football?
Well, Minnesota was the big rivalry. It was very intense, very friendly rivalry because there was so many Minnesota people in the state and vice versa. We had a lot of graduates up in Minneapolis in leading positions. So it was always a friendly but intense rivalry. And every game was a sellout, and invariably it would be a day almost like today where it was, the temperature could be at zero or even below. I remember my senior year when we stepped on the field, it was 10 above zero in Minneapolis, and the field had been covered with hay and was soft enough to get your cleats in, but the minute you hit the sidelines, you were on solid ice, so it was mighty cold weather, but that didn't stop the fans from filling up both stadiums. And in both cases, when the game would be in Minneapolis, there would be a special train that would leave the Northwestern station here, and hundreds of people would get on that train and party all the way up and party all that night in Minneapolis and go to the game and then get on the train and get on back late Saturday night in Madison.
Was it the Brown Jug, the rivalry where they passed the jug back?
No, the Brown Jug was between Michigan and
what was the one between Minnesota and Wisconsin?
The Paul Bunyan axe.
That's it
was a great big handled axe, and it had the scores painted up one side and down.
That was going at that point.
Yes, okay. Yes. Minnesota was a perennial power before the war, and they were frequently national champions. So Wisconsin's record against Minnesota before the war wasn't too good, and consequently we hardly knew the axe existed. But
now you went to school, and then you went off
to Michigan. We were at Michigan. University of Michigan for 3 semesters or 1 calendar year, and from there we went on into boot camp at Parris Island, South Carolina, and then officer training at Quantico, Virginia, and then most of us were shipped overseas. But fortunately for us, the war was just coming to an end, and as a matter of fact, I was on a troop transport heading for Guam, and I was going to be involved in the invasion of Japan when the atomic bombs were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And we got the reports on the ship that we were on. It was a little mimeographed newsletter that they put out in the ship's offices and passed around the ship. And of course, they announced over the speaker that the bombs had been dropped. And by the time we got to Hawaii on our way to Guam, why, the Japanese were suing for surrender. So we were very fortunate in that respect. So consequently, I don't agree with the people that say we should never have dropped the bomb, because it at the time the kamikaze planes were killing thousands of Americans, and it was a pretty it was quite a mess. The war was developing into quite a mess, and I think the invasion of Japan would have been an absolute slaughter. So I don't agree that the bomb was the wrong choice for Harry Truman to make.
So when the war did end, then you did come back and you finished that.
Yes. We were all back here in time for the fall of 1946, and we had the makings of a good team, except Elroy Hirsch did not come back. He had signed a pro contract, and Pat Harder had signed a pro contract, and we lost the nucleus of that great 42 team, and we didn't do so well. I think we probably went 4-5 or something like that. I forget what the record was, but the following year in 1947 we had a good team, and we were in contention for the Rose Bowl up until the last week. And however, we had lost to Michigan, and so they went to the Rose Bowl. That was the second Rose Bowl. Illinois had gone to the first one the year before.
So your schooling for that period was probably not all that atypical, in that you started in
1941
and you graduated in 1947.
48, actually.
With the intervening years of the war. And,
3 years in the military and 1 year at the University of Michigan, in between the two times that we were here at the university. So when we came back after the war, we were quite worldly, as you can expect most of the servicemen were, and it was a little bit hard to fit into the discipline of an undergraduate after spending time in service and being that much more mature. Some of us were already starting to get a few gray hairs, and it was a different. It was quite an experience to. Right after the war, freshmen were immediately eligible, so you had the combination of those of us who were back from the service. Let's see, that would be 22, maybe 23 years old. And young kids who had just graduated from high school, 17-year-old kids playing on the same team together. And I'm thinking of Red Wilson, who came from Milwaukee along with Lyle Blackburn, two fine young football players who played a lot as 17-year-old, but their eyes used to bulge out of their head when they hear some of the language that would come from some guy that spent 3 years in the Marine Corps.
It must have been almost like playing against professional players. I mean, people were so much older and had so
right.
much more experience.
Yes, it was.
Where did you live after the war?
Well, after the war, there was such a severe housing shortage that they had converted the upper stories of the stadium, the east side of the stadium, into dormitory rooms. And because we were all playing football and liked the convenience of it, why, we stayed in the stadium dormitories, and I stayed there until I graduated. I enjoyed it a little bit remote from the campus and participating in any club activities or anything like that. But again, we were so busy playing football and studying. Incidentally, we didn't have to worry about the meal jobs and the room jobs after the war because we were all on the GI Bill of Rights, and the government was paying for our food and our lodging at that point.
Was it mostly football player athletes who lived in the stadium dorms?
A lot of them did, but there were a lot of regular students in there as well because, again, rooms are so short, people would take a room wherever they could get it. And it was kind of cold and drafty in there, especially on a day like today when it's 7 below zero. The wind was whistling through those steel-plated glass windows, one thickness of glass.
When you were in college, was there anything like weight training or any of that kind of stuff?
No, absolutely no weight training. We never heard of it. We knew there were a few people pushing dumbbells around in a gym somewhere, but we would do a lot of calisthenics, push-ups, and things like that. And I know after the war, Rush Schultz came back down to school. He had been in service as well. But part of our training in La Crosse the summer before we came down was to each rent a rowboat and row upstream in the Mississippi River for a mile or so. And we were, in effect, lifting weights and not knowing it, but we knew that we were building up our arms and our shoulders by rowing upstream and then coasting down.
I'd just like to ask you a few questions about some people that you may or may not have had contact with in your undergraduate days at UW. First of all, you mentioned that Clarence Dykstra was president. Mm-hmm. Did you meet Dykstra at all?
Yes. We would see him, of course, at convocation and functions of that type. But I did have a chance to meet him when I mentioned we had we returned from Michigan on a weekend pass and practiced football with the Badgers. We also went up to President Dykstra's office and had our picture taken with Mr. Dykstra. And he was a very nice man. He didn't say anything about choosing the women Navy instead of us Marines, but we had a very nice chat with him, and that was my only real contact with Dr. Dykstra.
What impression did the students have generally of President?
Oh, I think, you know, he was like a god walking around. In those days, there was great respect for authority, we had one campus policeman, incidentally. Joe Hammersley was the only policeman on the campus, so you can perhaps tell from that there was a good deal of respect for authority, and that one policeman could handle the whole campus. And Dr. Dykstra had a big, long Buick that was parked up on Lincoln Terrace when he was in his office, and had a driver outside polishing the car, so there was a few trappings of the office that don't exist today.
One of my little sidelines through my involvement with the UW History Project and now with Oral History Project interviewing people, everybody seems to have a Joe Hammersley story. Do you have a Joe Hammersley story?
Oh, yes. We, when you played football, you always wore sweat socks that had a big red W on them, and a T-shirt that had Property UW Athletic Department on it. You would get a clean one every day, so you'd wear it to class and then go and practice with it and turn it in after you'd soiled it with football practice and wear it again. Well, every once in a while, one of those shirts or a pair of sweat socks would stick to your fingers and you'd take them home. And one of the players on the team had given a girl named Joan Hammersley a pair of these sweat socks when we left for the service, because you couldn't wear them in the service. And she was wearing them on the campus one day, and Joe Hammersley saw her with these W sweat socks and immediately demanded that she take the socks off. So she had to take her shoes and socks off, and it was quite a hullabaloo in the Daily Cardinal about Hammersley making the girl take her sweat socks off. So we wrote from Michigan, signed a petition that we thought it was a poor trick on his part to do this to Joan.
sounds like Joe. What about E.B. Fred?
E.B. Fred became president in 1945, so he was the president after the war. I didn't have occasion to meet him until we dedicated the Schreiner House of the dormitories in the spring of 1947, and I was asked to represent the students living in Schreiner House at the dedication, and Dr. and Mrs. Fred were there with Mr. and Mrs. Schreiner, and the governor and others were there. So I met Dr. Fred on the speaker's stand that day and enjoyed meeting him very much. And then, of course, in subsequent years, as I worked here, I became a very close friend of Dr. Fred.
Another campus figure throughout your entire stay there was Porter Butts. Did you have any thoughts?
No. Again, I didn't have a lot of time to be around the Union, and I think Porter, of course, was a dominant force in the Union. I'd go in there once in a while. We had our football training table where we would eat our evening meal there during the season. And I don't recall ever seeing him or hearing of him.
You just said something that I've been trying to nail down for a long time, the training table. What mm-hmm. is a training table?
Well, a training table is, in those days, during the football season, from the start of practice on usually September 1 until the first game, September 18th or 20th or somewhere in there, 3 weeks of practice, the university was allowed to give us three meals a day, and they were well-prepared meals, dietitian, give us plenty of energy. And then once the season started, then you were permitted by the conference to give the evening meal to the team after practice. So about 7 o'clock every evening, we would go to the Union cafeteria, and actually we'd eat in a separate room, but we would go through the cafeteria and pick up usually all the milk that you wanted to drink and a big piece of meat and mashed potatoes and vegetables, and again, just an excellent meal, much better than you could afford in your own right.
So this was certainly one of the perks of being on the football.
That was a perk, and the day the last practice ended, that's the last meal you got until the following year.
Then you're back to buttermilk.
Yeah.
You mentioned off tape that you didn't have any contact, fortunately, with the Dean of Men.
No, I didn't. In fact, I doubt if I knew his name at the
Scott
time.
Goodnight.
Scott Goodnight. I've heard many stories after, mostly from people before our time, because I think he was calming down about the time I was here. He was perhaps approaching retirement, but I've heard a lot of stories about him, but I had no contact with him, fortunately for me.
He retired in 1945, and the people who know the situation said it's lucky for him that he did, because the veterans would have been the death of him.
I don't think they'd have taken much to his sitting on a rocking chair waiting for somebody to come out of a house.
Yeah, the rocking chair incident. Let's talk a little bit about your leisure time. This is something that I probably get through quickly, because it doesn't sound like you had a whole lot.
No, we really didn't, and we of course, had such closeness among the freshman football players that we would have most of our leisure time fun associated with walking home from football practice or sitting around after practice and talking. We did go over to the Union to they had dances on Sunday afternoon. You didn't want to be caught dead there during the season dancing, but when the football season was over with, it was permissible to go dancing at that time. So we'd go over and again, the biggest attraction was that they had free cookies and milk at these Get Acquainted dances in the Union. But didn't have a lot of time for socializing.
What were the major social events of the year?
Well, the two big social events were military ball and the prom. And for those, you had to wear a tux, or rather a tails. And I had never really seen one, let alone put one on, and other than in the movies. And so usually, I know I didn't attend, and none of my close friends were. But the big people on campus, the BMOCs, were always very large at mill ball and prom.
What about prevailing student attitudes towards like alcohol and tobacco?
Well, in those days, you could drink beer when you were 18 years old, and hard liquor when you were 21. So most of the people, that, you know, coming from Wisconsin, beer was a perfectly normal thing to do. Most of us did not have cars, so we didn't have the problem of drinking and driving. We're, again, coming off the Depression, and it was rare when somebody would have an automobile. We'd take buses around or mostly walk to get where we're going. So, and the Union served beer. We were famous as we went through the military and subsequent years to tell people we were from Wisconsin. The first question they'd ask us, oh, is that where they serve beer at the Union? And so it was kind of natural. There's so many breweries in the state and so many people of German heritage, I guess, made it quite natural for beer to be consumed. But we didn't drink it during the season.
Was that near beer?
No, it was 3.2%, as I recall. But we were very careful to abide by the training rules, because if you didn't, you were kicked off, and that meant no smoking and no drinking. And I felt very fortunate that no smoking, I've been able to follow through, and I never did smoke.
Let's go a little bit about financing of your education. Do you remember what tuition was when you came here?
I think it was $48 a semester, if I'm not mistaken, $96 a year. It was a bargain by today's rates, but it still was a lot of money in those days. I mentioned that I had stayed out of school a year because I wanted to grow a little and especially save some money to pay my tuition and that down at the university. So I worked at the train company in La Crosse for a full year and saved almost everything that they paid me, and I would use that to pay for my room, or rather for my tuition and my books. And then the others I work for, as I mentioned earlier.
So you didn't have any loans or anything like that?
No. I don't think there was such a thing as a loan. You might have been able to get one in your home bank or from some person in your hometown, but
Scholarships? Were there many of those?
Well, there were a few scholarships, but they were really quite limited, and I know I wasn't aware of any that I could have really applied for.
Now, we saw a big change after World War II in the makeup of students, mm-hmm. the student body across the country. Mm-hmm. One of the big reasons was something you already mentioned, the GI Bill.
Right.
Could you just explain briefly how that worked?
Well, any young man or woman that came out of service was entitled to, I forget how much money it was, but essentially it took care of your room and board and tuition, and I don't think it covered all of your eating, but it came pretty close to covering your basic expenses. And you would most of the most of the fellows that I knew had saved money from when they were in service. They had bought war bonds and so forth out of our salary or out of our pay as Marines. And with the war over with, we cashed those in and used that money for... By the time I finished 2 years of school after the war, I was essentially broke. But I had my education and had a good time.
What happened also with the GI Bill is it brought in different types of students who hadn't been promoted for one reason or another to attend campus, and campuses in large numbers. I want to talk for a minute about the student attitudes that you saw in your your longer period of time than the general undergraduate because of the interruption of the war. Did you, in terms of attitudes toward, let's start with Jews, did you notice, were you aware of any discrimination here at UW?
I wasn't aware of any organized discrimination against them, but I know that, in fact, there was a fellow who was kind of a renegade on the football team who took particular delight in going to the campus soda grill where a lot of Jewish students gathered and picking a fight or starting an argument there. But that was really the only overt discrimination I saw. I think at the time most of the fellows who had fought in Europe, of course, knew what they were fighting in Adolf Hitler and the Holocaust, and I think they were perhaps more sympathetic to him than they had been well before the war or after the war. But I'm sure there was discrimination, but I wasn't aware of it. And we didn't see any of it at all in the football circles. In fact, we had the first two black players on our 1946 and 47 team, Cal Vernon and Bob Teague. And Bob went on to be a famous announcer in New York City television, and he was on the Today Show for a while. And Cal Vernon, I saw him just a few weeks ago at a reunion as a professional man in Chicago and doing very well.
Were they here under the GI Bill?
No, I don't believe they were. I think Vernon was a recent high school graduate, and I don't know what Teague was.
In the 30s, several of the people who were students at that time talked about the dealings with the communist threat on campus, mm-hmm. and UW has since, it seems like forever, been a hotbed of communism and all that. Did you notice, was any of that an issue when you were attending school?
You would notice that the very liberal causes were being supported, but because there was such an overwhelming number of military veterans on the campus, and they were a no-nonsense group. You know, if they saw somebody saying something against the United States, why, they immediately reverted to their military status and would shut them up in a hurry. So there wasn't much of that going on at all.
Just a final question about your religion. In La Crosse and at UW, could you discuss that for a moment?
I was a Lutheran, as of course many people in Wisconsin are. I would go to the Lutheran Student Center here really only for church services. I didn't participate in any of the social functions or clubs because, again, I was so busy with the other things that I had to do.
Any closing observations you'd like to make on your years here at UW?
Well, I found that it satisfied me completely as to what I expected. When I mentioned, even as a little boy, I used to listen to Russ Winnie announce the Badger football games, and I never missed a game on the radio, and I dreamed of coming here to school. When I got here, I can say I loved every minute of it, and I thought it was a wonderful experience. I made some friendships that are still my very closest friends, and I found it a totally enjoyable and rewarding experience, and I've always felt that anybody who came to the university could find that same thing here. There are pitfalls, of course, and a lot of people get into difficulties and into situations that perhaps aren't so good, but generally speaking, I think it's a wonderful institution and still is, and perhaps always will be.
When is this institution going to go to the Rose Bowl again?
Well, we got the right man in Pat Richter to lead us out there, I hope. He gets the right coach. I think that Wisconsin showed in 1942 that we were basically a team made up of kids from the state. So they're good football players growing and playing in the state. And I think if we get the right combination with Pat Richter and who the new coach will be, that we'll be able to get the kids from Wisconsin to come here to school again and have a great team.
Thank you. I've just interviewed Mr. Robert Rennebaum of the University of Wisconsin Foundation on his undergraduate days here at the university. We will be getting together again in the near future to talk about his stint as director of the University of Wisconsin Foundation from, 1955 to 1988?
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, and...